In a book review several years ago, Michael Shermer, science writer, founding publisher of Skeptic magazine, asserted, "Humans are by nature pattern-seeking, storytelling animals." And he continued, "We're quite adept at telling stories about patterns, whether they exist or not." His is an observation stated more recently in Cody Dellastrati's Atlantic Monthly article entitled "The Psychological Comforts of Storytelling." Stories, he said, allow people to see patterns. Mindful of that, theologian John S. Donne poses a key human question. What kind of story are we in? What kind of story are we in? Is it a dystopia, spiraling downward toward some deleterious end? Is it a utopia, an arc leading, if only in some distant time and place, toward harmony and universal well-being? Is it a cycle, rising and falling in various epochs, showing neither serious decline nor obvious indications of lasting progress? We seek the patterns. We tell the stories about the patterns, whether, as Michael Shermer admits, whether they exist or not. In a presidential election cycle that is, to this point, bizarre beyond belief, there is one curious similarity between the two candidates at the extremes. I'm not talking about the fact that they are both having really bad hair days, maybe even bad hair adulthoods. What I have in mind is this: both blustering Donald Trump and bellicose Bernie Sanders are telling the same story. They see the same overall pattern. What kind of story are we in? A calamity. A tragedy. A nightmare. Things are woefully off track. Things are bad, and short of intervention and reversal, they are almost certainly going to get worse. Now, obviously, their reasons for this assessment are radically different. The cure for our societal ills, more radically different still. But their stories, the pattern that they see, they're quite similar. Now, it won't likely surprise most of you that I gravitate considerably more to one of these storytellers than to the other. No endorsements ever from the pulpit. Today, in these few moments, however, I am offering an astounding assertion. Seen from the perspective of human history, they are both telling the wrong story. For a short synopsis, I'll take my cues from a colleague. William F. Schultz has served as the president of our denomination, the executive director of Amnesty International, and of our Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. Bill has been a witness to some of the worst that we humans do to one another and to our planet. So it gets our attention when he asserts it is impossible. It is impossible to argue credibly that, on balance, humankind has not made enormous progress. Bill is saying that the story, that the pattern, is quite clear. As a species, we are without a doubt making progress. That's my message today. at least. Echoing Bill, echoing Jane Goodall and Howard Zinn, I'm contending that there are ample causes and cases for hope. Let's start where it's hard, maybe the hardest, with violence. Here and for a bit, I'll rely on Steven Pinker in his surprising book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. Pinker admits our cognitive faculties predispose us to believe that we live in violent times. Even missing the most fear-mongering of them all, Republicans stumbled all over one another again this week, vying for who could tell the loudest, most belligerent story about violence, not only as a problem, but ironically as the cure. They're wrong. They see the pattern. They tell the stories. They're just telling the wrong stories. Believe it or not, Steven Pinker writes, and I know most people do not, violence has declined. Violence has declined over long stretches of time. And today we may be living, he says, in the most peaceable era in the species' existence. With careful documentation, he demonstrates how violence internationally, nationally, communally, and interpersonally has declined. Casualties from war, though better publicized than ever before, are down. The 20th century was the bloodiest in history, he says, is a cliche. It's a cliche that has been used to indict a range of demons, a vast range of demons, but is rarely backed up by numbers from any century other than the 20th. Pinker notes that we have gone from aggrandizing military actions with statues, sculptures, and victory arches to war memorials depicting not proud commanders on horseback, but weeping mothers, weary soldiers, or exhaustive lists of names of the dead. The resort to violence, though always front page news, has declined. Pinker reminds us of 16th century Queen Mary of England, so-called Bloody Mary, who earned her gruesome sobriquet by burning thousands of religious dissidents at the stake. Today he writes, the British royal family is excoriated for shortcomings ranging from rudeness to infidelity. You'd think people would give them credit for not having had a single relative decapitated, nor a single rival drawn and quartered. He reminds us of the prominent history of dueling in our own nation, a violent defense of honor that spelled the demise of Alexander Hamilton, who died, as Broadway now reminds us, at the hands of the vice president. Now, Dick Cheney may have been a reckless shot, but there's not much to suggest that he was actually aiming to kill. I think. In that case, the one that we know about. One has only to go back a few decades to a time when it was considered good television entertainment, comedy, for a burly bus driver to threaten his wife repeatedly. One of these days, Alice. One of these days, pal. Right in the kisser. Thankfully, that kind of domestic violent threat is no longer considered funny or acceptable as a form of comedy. At the same time that Jackie Gleason was making those threats, print advertisements for Chase and Sanborn Coffee and Van Heusen shirts both depicted a husband striking his wife. And in an ad for Pitney Bowes, a furious boss screamed, "Is it always illegal to kill a woman?" Just imagine an advertiser trying that tack in next week's game. Echoing mid-19th century Unitarian minister Theodore Parker's confidence that the arc of the moral universe bends toward justice, Pinker reports, "A century and a half later, our eyes can see that the arc has bent toward justice in ways that Parker could not have imagined." He cites as evidence our deep engagement in advocacy for animal rights, gay rights, children's rights, women's rights, and civil rights. Pinker gives credit where it is rightfully due, to reason, to science, to humanism, to individual rights. He's not at all Pollyanna, admitting that these forces have not pushed steadily in one direction, nor will they ever bring about a utopia or end the frictions and hurts that come with being human. He doesn't suggest we're all living in nirvana. The shift, he says, is not toward complacency. We enjoy the peace we find today because people in past generations were appalled by the violence in their time and worked to reduce it. And so we should work to reduce the violence that remains in our time. But backed by statistical evidence, he does declare the decline of violence may be the most significant and least appreciated development in the history of our species. Telling a hopeful story is not naive. There are causes and cases for hope. Peter Diamandis and Stephen Kotler pick up the theme. In their more controversial book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think, they offer a similar story. Consider, for example, their reminder that the 20th century saw infant mortality decrease by 90%. Maternal mortality decreased by 99%. And overall human lifespan increased by 100%. When I hear some people waxing nostalgic or suggesting that we aren't really getting anywhere, I sometimes ask them, in what prior medical age would you like to relocate yourself? For all of the mind-boggling brokenness in our healthcare system, we have landed on the planet in the best time ever. Writing their book in 2012, almost a generation ago in technological eras, they point out, right now a Maasai warrior with a cell phone has better mobile phone capabilities than the President of the United States did 25 years ago. And if he's on a smartphone with access to Google, then he has better access to information than the president did just 15 years ago. It's something I witnessed a few years ago in rural, remote India. While talking to a village leader, he received a phone call on one of his two cell phones, phones he sometimes charged by solar power. It was a mother reporting that her daughter had been bitten by a viper. Now in this age, he was able to summon immediate medical assistance, heightening the likelihood that a tragedy would not result in a fatality. It's remarkable. For all of their challenges, science and technology are giving humankind some of the best gifts we've ever gotten. As I read hundreds of pages in anticipation of this service, the thing that surprised me most of all was the sense of hope that was coming from some of the world's leading environmentalists. Sebastian Choing, one of the world's authorities on oceans, readily admits all of our oceans are under assault from human activities. He urges we need significant action to secure ocean health and prosperity. But then he adds, several recent developments make me confident that we can put oceans on a path to recovery. Choing says, for example, there's a dramatic increase in the number and size of marine protected areas. The signs of fisheries recovery are growing. Technology is increasing our capacity to monitor and enforce a more sustainable relationship with our oceans. There's increased awareness of the issues and the concerns. And he says, from the perspective of someone who has been deeply engaged in this work for a quarter century, there is a growing appetite for global action on oceans, resulting in conservation actions that are recovering endangered species. He's far from alone in his hope. Maybe you too have seen the 15-year-old indigenous climate activist Xochitl Rasque Martinez, who has already addressed the United Nations twice. Voicing his Aztec tradition, he contends, in light of the collapsing world, what better time to be alive than now? Because our generation gets to change the course of history. Humans have created the greatest problems we face today, he admits. But then he also asserts, the greater the challenge, the higher we will rise to meet it. Perhaps it's for that reason that Jane Goodall urges, let us have faith. Let us have faith in ourselves, in our intellect, in our staunch spirit, and in our young people. Most of us have probably heard the Cherokee story of the grandfather who says to his grandson, a fight is going on inside me. It's a terrible fight between two wolves. One is evil. He's anger, envy, greed, arrogance, lies. The other's good. He is joy, peace, love, humility, kindness, compassion. The same fight, he says to his young grandson, the same fight's going on inside you and inside every other person too. Grandson thought about it for a moment and then asked his grandfather, which wolf will win? The old Cherokee simply replied, The one you feed. We here exist in part to feed the good wolves, to nurture and nourish the better angels of our nature. Here we serve hope, not naive optimism, not blithe, irrational belief that everything is going to be okay. Not some pithy sentiment that we're all doing the best we can. Our deep sense of spiritual meaning calls us to hope, to looking for, to seeing, to noticing, a trajectory suggesting that hope simply makes more rational sense than despair. There are causes and cases for hope. These have a great deal to do with the patterns that we perceive and with the stories that we tell. No less a critic than Howard Zinn professes his faith. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact. On the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize, what we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives.